Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 4th, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at a few issues. First, we're going to start with a discussion about an issue that arose on some of the online discussion forums I am involved with. The key issue revolving around the question of how we're going to tax state tax refunds next year if you have a taxpayer that went above the $10,000 SALT limitation. We'll talk about another case that came down in the marijuana industry. This is a case of Feinberg versus Commissioner, and actually it's the second trip of Feinberg to the 10th Circuit. This time wasn't quite as successful for them. We'll talk about a case where the IRS won a case that's going to affect probably everybody listening to this. The IRS now has the ability to charge fees for the P10. We'll talk about how that original decision got reversed this week and potentially what's going to happen next. We'll talk about a case here of the IRS at the very last second granting an extension to farmers and fishermen to pay their taxes without getting hit with payment, with underpayment penalties, in essence pushing what's normally the March 1st deadline back to April 15th. We'll talk about the case of Wahlquist versus Commissioner, tax court reported decision that continues a line of cases that's been developing regarding the IRS's need to approve penalties prior to assessment. And we'll talk about this case deals with an automated system where a taxpayer is an underreporter. And finally, an IRS loss in the Ninth Circuit, JBPB versus United States of America. That particular case involves the requirement the IRS gives adequate notice before contacting third parties. What we'll discover is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the IRS's view, which the Taxpayer Advocate's Office has indicated is increasingly being used by the service across the country, that the mere giving a taxpayer publication one at the start of an exam is sufficient to apprise the taxpayer the IRS may contact third parties later in the exam. In this particular case, the IRS did the contact for third parties 2 years after the exam started. It's been a busy week, and by the way, mentioned the Taxpayer's Advocate. For those who hadn't heard, the current Taxpayer Advocate, Nina Olson, is actually going to be retiring July 31st. We'll have a change there because Nina's been there since 2001, as I recall. So it's been a while. We're getting a new Taxpayer Advocate, if you're aware of that. And it's also, as we've noted, it's time the tax season is in full run, full bore, we're going. And we still have a lot of issues on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that haven't been clarified yet, probably won't be clarified even by the end of tax season. So it's going to be an interesting run because, as you're aware, we're here at March 4th. We're coming up on the March 15th filing deadline for S corporations and partnerships. And yeah, we're going to have a lot of missing items when those extensions come up. Good news is they're pass-throughs. So generally, unless there's a built-in gains tax for the S-Corp, we don't have a problem with paying tax at that deadline. But we are going to have the problem that I doubt we're going to see a lot of this guidance by April 15th when we are going to have to worry about actually paying taxes for the individuals in the C-Corps. So interesting time of year, and we'll get started now looking at our cases this week. Actually, I'm going to start with a non-case, an article that I wrote on the website. And it was based on a series of online discussions I saw in different news groups at about the same time. And what that discussion talked about was the issue of tax refunds. The issue arises because of the fact that we now have a limitation of $10,000 on Schedule A for deduction of most taxes that go on Schedule A. That includes taxes such as personal income taxes, real estate taxes on personal property, and personal property taxes. If you have a lieu tax charge for autos in your state, that would go there as well. Now, many taxpayers are going to run into, at least the estimate this week that was published, was about 11 million taxpayers will hit this limitation where they're going to be above 10 grand. And the question arises, what if those taxpayers, when they finish their state return for the year, end up getting a state income tax refund? How do we end up taxing that refund? It was reported that some tax software has been publishing, because you know tax software loves to publish things and tell us things. And so it publishes like a note about information about this return and says, you know, state tax refund that will be taxable next year. And those software, some of the software was using a proration method. That means if you had, let's say, $15,000 worth of total taxes on the return and $10,000 of them were income taxes, that it would treat two-thirds of your refund as being taxable, right? That'd be structure number one. There's a couple of other prorations that could be used. but various ways they're getting a prorated amount. That's true if you got, so if you got a $1,000 refund, you would end up paying tax on, according to that calculation, $667 of the refund, because two-thirds of your tax deduction represented income taxes. And the question quickly becomes, gang, is that correct? And I think the answer very clearly per the Internal Revenue Code is the answer is not correct. What's missing here is a consideration of Internal Revenue Code Section 111. And I realize, you know, you got to go dig, but 111 has been the code for a long time. It was, as I recall, the history of this section, it is actually Congress making statutory a doctrine the courts had developed called the tax benefit doctrine. And what Section 111 tells us right away, 111A, is our income does not include income attributable to the recovery during a taxable year of any amount deducted in any prior taxable year to the extent the amount did not reduce the maximum amount of tax imposed by the chapter. Now, in doing that, Section 111C tells us that we have to consider not just did it reduce tax in the current year, but did it impact a carryover, maybe an NOL carryover, maybe a capital loss carryover. So did it impact something like that, which then, while we may not have had tax due this year and may not have affected this year's tax, it could affect tax in the future. If any of that's true, then the amount that affects that is taxable. But otherwise, Section 111 prevents us from having to recognize that tax. And the actual mechanics of the recognition, the amount you don't recognize, is called the recovery exclusion. In Regulation 1.111-1B2, it tells us how to compute this exclusion. Basically, it is the maximum amount of deduction that could have been left off the return. They kind of phrase it like an agent comes in and disallows. How much of the deduction could have been disallowed by the agent and not have changed the tax or carryovers from that return? Up to that amount is per Section 111 not taxable. There's no reference in Section 111 to somehow prorating this deduction or somehow figuring out anything else. Section 111 is a very absolute test. If there was no benefit from the deduction, you do not claim the deduction. This has become an issue because some people are fretting and they're going in and actually overriding to try to make sure that it chooses state sales taxes rather than income taxes. And of course, this freaks out people in states like Oregon, because in Oregon, you don't have a state sales tax you could use in lieu of income tax. And so does that mean you're just kind of in trouble? And I think the answer is no. Now, I think that this is pretty clear. Now, we have an example in the write-up in the article, and you can download this with a PDF this week. We have it. But let's start with a very simple example, you know, where we have that. Because under Section 111, we've got that. The reg tells us. So we have a couple here, Joe and Denise Smith, and their taxes for the year are $7,000 of real estate taxes and $7,000 of state income taxes. Now, that totals to $14,000, and on Schedule A, they're going to be blocked, only deducting 10, because none of these are the, quote, line 9 taxes that we sometimes have been discussing on the forums, which are taxes that are not subject to 10 grand limitation, but are still deducted on Schedule A. These are neither of those, so we've got that. So we've got $14,000 of tax. Obviously, when we prepare the return, there's only going to get a benefit for $10,000 worth of that tax. And let's say when they do the return, let's put them in Oregon for, you know, just for the sake of fun. They get a $2,000 refund from the state of Oregon. Now, the question is, under 2019 return, of course, the state of Oregon will dutifully issue that 1099-G to them next year. So the question becomes, what do we do about that $2,000? And the answer becomes fairly quickly, well, actually not going to be a problem. Why? Go back under Reg 1.111-1, and let's see. What if an agent, instead of that being a refund, let's say an agent simply came and examined 18 and said, you did not pay that $2,000. Let's say that $2,000 represented you, you know, you fouled this up. There was an estimated tax payment that was actually paid in January of 2019. So we're going to take that off the 18 return. Sorry, you can't deduct it. Would the tax have changed? The answer is no. Now we'd have $12,000 worth of those limited taxes. And again, our deduction would be 10 grand. Our taxable income would not change by a dollar. Our tax would not change by a dollar. As such, none of the $2,000 is deductible. Or I should say is taxable. Now let's change the facts just a little. Let's assume they got a $5,000 refund on the same facts. In that scenario, yes, if we had not deducted the $5,000, then our tax would have been $9,000 on Schedule A. And guess what? Our taxable income would have gone up by $1,000 and our tax would go up by their marginal rate times that $1,000 difference. So now we don't get totally covered by 111, but we're still partially covered. Why? Because up to $4,000 of that deductible tax, up to $4,000 of that $7,000 of state income taxes could have been disallowed on exam, and it still wouldn't have caused us to pay a dollar more tax, nor would it have affected the carryover. So only the final $1,000 of that refund is going to be taxable in a 2019 return as a taxable refund of state income taxes. And again, this is fairly clear. The regulation is pretty simple. And obviously, unless you're in that special case where we're right on the cusp and the refund kicks us back under, in most cases where a taxpayer is limited by the 10 grand limitation, you're going to find the state income tax refunds are simply not going to be deductible under a proper computation of the tax benefit rule under Section 111 of the code. And by the way, this is code. So code, you know, unless that's an unconstitutional provision, which I kind of doubt, or it's somehow covered by a tax treaty, which I also somehow doubt, it's going to be the rule. And that rule is fairly clear. And therefore, I think that all this concern about, oh, having to dig through and making an election to do state income taxes or do sales taxes is actually a lot of work for nothing. It's not really going to be the issue. So, you know, don't worry about that. There's enough things to worry about this year. This is not one of them. Let's move on to now a new case in the marijuana industry. Feinberg et al. Versus Commissioner. This is case number 189005 from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, issued on February the 26th. This is an appeal of a case coming out of Colorado. And this was an examination of a marijuana dispensary. It actually been going on for a while. If you're aware, Section 280 CAPI of the code denies to businesses that deal in controlled substances as defined by Congress, and marijuana is written into the code as a controlled substance, a type 1 controlled substance that has no medical benefit. Okay, we don't care whether the argument is it does or doesn't. Irrelevant. Congress has put it there. The Supreme Court has told us they can put it there. So, you know, that argument has to be taken back up with the nine justices in D.C. If we have that type, if we have things that are controlled substances, we cannot claim deductions for anything except cost of sales. That's the way 280 CAPI works. So the problem then becomes, now here's the issue. So we're examining this marijuana dispensary. There were two dispensaries that they had. And supposedly, my understanding is this particular dispensary was the largest dispensary at the time, medical marijuana dispensary in the state of Colorado. This predates recreational marijuana in Colorado. So it was a medical marijuana structure that was involved. In this particular case, the IRS went in, did an examination. They did some changes, but then they decided that, well, we want to get some information on what they do so that we can lock down this whole 280E structure. At least that appears to be their issue. Now, remember, this is an entity that's already licensed by the state of Colorado to be a medical marijuana dispensary. You know, it advertised that it did it. So it seems like the IRS was kind of going for belts and suspenders here by trying to get it. So they put a request for documents to the dispensary. They asked them for documents that would prove what they were doing. The dispensary said that violates our Fifth Amendment rights, and they filed suit. Now, the case actually went up at this point to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And if you read the write-up or the court case, they're going to refer to that case as Feinberg 1. That went up in 2015. And the 10th Circuit really didn't deal with that issue at that level, except to note that we could deal with this on appeal. If it's a problem, they said it presents a unique set of circumstances, whether the IRS could compel production. Well, the IRS apparently decided that, you know, we're just not going to go there. We're not going to touch that because that could put the whole case at risk if they go down that route. So what they did was they simply disallowed the deduction. They said, you know what? I'm not really sure we need a whole lot more evidence. Well, that's great, except the tax court apparently also spooked by the 10th Circuit's ruling and then spooked by the IRS feeling for some reason they had to go prove it was a dispensary. They came out and said, no, it was all disallowed because they hadn't gotten proper documentation of their expenses. Well, of course, the IRS had never argued the expenses weren't documented. They just argued they weren't deductible. And so both the dispensary and the IRS agreed in the appeal that the tax court had decided this case on a grounds that the IRS had not argued. it was a new item brought up. Had it actually IRS tried to argue it, the burden would have been on the IRS to prove they hadn't adequately documented. So the 10th Circuit, okay, the 10th Circuit already had set up the tax court's decision is wrong. But the IRS said, but you should sustain the result of the decision on the alternative ground that, you know, that the marijuana dispensary never overcame our assertion that they were barred from any of these expenses under 280 cap B because that was our position. The dispensary said, wait, we're going right back in the Fifth Amendment problem now. Because in order for us to produce evidence of what we do, that could force us to reveal what may be incriminating evidence of a federal crime. And we should not have to do that. That's the way it works. Unfortunately, the 10th Circuit said, guys, this is a little different. See, the cases you're citing for why you don't have to do this were cases where there was a criminal penalty for not doing certain disclosures. If that particular disclosure would trigger a Fifth Amendment problem, then the courts have held that that law could not be enforced that required you to have, you know, that basically penalized you for failing to disclose. However, they said, this is different. This is a civil case. You're trying to justify your right to deductions. The IRS is presumed correct. It is up to you to prove they aren't. Because if you, they said, you got a choice here to make. Either you can bring out the evidence, and once you do, you're going to waive the Fifth Amendment privilege on this stuff, but you could bring out evidence showing you weren't a dispensary. Or you can sit back, claim Fifth Amendment, and then the IRS's presumption of correctness will carry the day. The dispensary obviously did not produce this evidence, so the 10th Circuit said IRS is right. The tax court should have decided this based solely on the 280E rule because the taxpayer presented no evidence to counter the IRS position. That they, you know, the IRS position that this was a dispensary, failing to have countered that IRS assertion, basically the dispensary is stuck with no deduction. Your choice is not a choice you like. In fact, in a footnote, that's what they say at the end, is probably not a choice you're going to like, but it's a choice you have to make here. You know, you want to claim the Fifth Amendment protection. You can't, you're basically stuck with having your deductions thrown out because otherwise you've got to prove, you know, the issues like, what of your business represents trafficking? What doesn't? Do you actually have two trades or businesses? All those potential defenses from the Champ case, you know, Champ did not keep that information off when the Champ, those who remember the Champ case, you know, which was the key tax court case that gave us two trades or businesses in marijuana dispensary structures. Champ didn't keep that out of there. I mean, sorry, Feinberg, if you're going to try to do a Champ defense, you've got to bring evidence showing what each part of your business is, and you'd also have to prove two trades or businesses. And if you don't want to do that, well, then you're just going to lose everything. That's, you know, your choice. Next up, a case that some of you may remember, and it's under a different name than it was the district court because a whole group of people who were involved in the suit. So now, and they went for a name that's more difficult for me to pronounce, Montrois versus United States. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, and I apologize to the individual involved. This is case number 17-5204. From the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, issued on March the 1st. And the issue in this question is, can the IRS charge tax preparers for issuing and renewing P-10s? You may remember that we had a district court case back 2 years ago that ruled the IRS could not charge either to issue or to renew P-10s. And since that point in time, the IRS has not been charging you for your P-10s. So all you had to do this year was go online. If you, as long as you were qualified to renew, like you're filing your tax returns, little details like that. As long as you're qualified to renew, the IRS issued you a brand new P-10. Now the IRS stopped charging for it because the district court issued an order saying they had to do so. But the IRS also filed an appeal with the Court of Appeals, and they didn't ask the Court of Appeals to block that court order in the interim. But the IRS said, we retain the right to charge and we're actually going to move forward. When they actually stopped collecting, they told us that, you know, this is not necessarily the end of the story. Please, you know, stay tuned. Well, we've stayed tuned. So those of you who thought you're going to be getting a refund, which the district court ordered, that's not going to happen. And secondly, we are probably going to be paying for P-10s again. Probably next year's renewal, although I suppose depending on how this is finally decided, the IRS could try to go back and collect for the 2 years you didn't pay. We'll just have to see how it goes. That'll be the key. The Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the ruling at the trial court. What the trial court had said, the trial court said, well, the IRS proposed this fee initially. The P10 program began back in the late 80s. Congress authorized the program. At the time they authorized the program, Congress's reasons for authorizing P10s was to allow tax preparers to use something other than their Social Security number on the tax return. Those of you who remember doing returns back then, you probably remember that we used to have to put our ID number on the copy of the return that went to the IRS. Now, you didn't have to put that number on the copy of the return that went to the client. But nevertheless, you still had to remember that that was before electronic filing for the most part. We were just at the beginning of the e-filing system at that point. So basically, clients were always given the return to mail in, and that return to mail in always had your Social Security number on it. And people began to get nervous about ID theft even back then. It's not just a totally modern issue of ID theft. It actually was a worry back there in the late 80s. So what the IRS and the Congress came up with was this system called the P-TIN. The Congress authorized the IRS to issue these things called P-TINs. And initially, P-TINs were voluntary. You could either get a P-TIN or you could use your Social Security number. The IRS eventually made P-10s mandatory at the same time they decided that they were going to start requiring people to be registered return preparers unless they were a CPA, EA, or attorney. They were a CERC 230 practitioner. Non-CERC 230 practitioners would have to pass this exam. In the Loving case, that was thrown out. And by the way, the DC Circuit agreed. The Loving case threw that out. But after Loving, the IRS came back, they reduced the fee from $50 to $35 because they've been $50. They decided to charge a fee because it's going to cost money to set up this program and to administer the P10 program in general. So they reduced that fee to $35, and then there was always this additional charge because you used a third-party service. You had to pay for that fee as well. But they reduced it to $35. The lawsuit was filed saying, look, you got rid of this registration program that was the reason you even thought of charging a fee. So you no longer have a right to charge a fee. The district court said, well, we think it does violate the law. The IRS has a right to require P-10s. They did dismiss that part of the suit. But they said, but this fee problem, nope, they really have no right to do it because they're giving nothing of benefit to the preparer. And it's nothing of benefit because anybody can walk in and get a P-10. Back when they were going to do the registered return preparer program, had they been allowed to do that, then that would have been a benefit, and that benefit would have allowed them to charge for it. But now there's no benefit because anybody can get one. The DC Court of Appeals said, nah, now we're not buying that. District court, you got it wrong. There was a benefit provided tax preparers. The benefit is that thing that started back in the late 80s. Congress established this program to give paid preparers a way to file returns without their social, without disclosing it. The P-10 program grants that benefits to preparers. They said, we don't care that everybody could walk in and get a P-10. First thing is, let's be honest, everybody won't. And secondly, no, it's a specific benefit that you get to be a paid preparer. You're given a number that allows you not to expose your Social Security number, because if we didn't use P-10s, we'd be back to using ID numbers, and that would be we'd be back using our Social Security numbers, and that would be a problem. So because of that, the IRS is authorized. Now, the parties here that were suing also claimed the IRS's fees were unreasonable. And the court said, the Court of Appeals said, well, that was never actually litigated at court because, it was decided on summary judgment that the IRS had no right to charge any fee. So that's being sent back to the district court for litigation, for final trial and for bringing out evidence. We'll see how this moves going forward, but the likelihood is that you're going to be finding next year, there's probably going to be a fee to renew your P-10. So just be ready for that. Be ready for the fees to start coming again. We got a little break here, but the break's over. Next up, talk about waiting to the last second. Notice 2019-17, issued on February the 28th. Generally, farmers and fishermen, you have to meet certain requirements to be a farmer or fisherman, right? And those of you who do this know the basic rule of 2/3 of gross income coming from farming or fishing. You're a farmer or fisherman for this purpose. And if you are, you get a break on estimated taxes. You can either pay a single estimated tax payment by January 15th, or you can file, and it should be there, file and pay by March 1st, not by 228, but by March 1st. So if you file and pay the taxes due by March 1st, then you're okay, even though you didn't pay any estimated taxes at all during the year. Farmers and fishermen were allowed to do that. The argument being at the time when this was put in the law that they have trouble estimating their income because it all matters on how the crop or the catch comes in. Okay. Based on that, they get a special rule. We can argue whether that's fair or not because there are other businesses where we might have that same problem, but we don't get the benefit. Nevertheless, they get the benefit. We'll accept that. Well, the problem, of course, is that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has created a lot of uncertainty. And what was interesting was that normally somewhere toward the end of February, about a week plus out from the deadline for this filing, the IRS sends out a notice news release saying, hey, by the way, farmers and fishermen, you really got to remember, you need to get your returns done by the 1st of March, you know, if you want to pay your tax and avoid the penalties for underpayment of estimated taxes. You get it all done and in by that date. They had not issued that notice this year. There were plenty of rumors going around that that was because they were going to go back as they have in the past, and they were going to extend the date for filing for farmers and fishermen. However, while that rumor persisted for almost all of last week, it wasn't until the day before the deadline that the IRS issued Notice 2019-17, extended that relief to April 15th. So at this point, farmers and fishermen can get the extended relief through April 15th. The notice does tell you how to get that relief, and you do it, as you might expect, by attaching Form 2210-F, underpayment of estimated tax by farmer and fisherman, to the 2018 return, and you should put your name and ID number, and you do the waiver box, which is Part 1, Box A, should be checked, everything else left blank. That's how you indicate you qualify for this benefit. So, if you actually rush like mad and you got the returns done, and everything was taken care of and paid in by March 1st, well, okay, you're ahead of the game, I guess, but you're still out the money. If your farmers or fishermen did not get things together by that time, you do still have now the April 15th deadline that you can work with, where they could pay the tax in by that date, file the return, pay the tax in by that date, they will escape the underpayment penalties. Okay. Hey, a couple of cases to close out here. Let's start with Wahlquist. This is the Wahlquist case, 152 TC number 3, February 25th of 2019. This is one of a series of cases we've had that deal with IRS's penalty assessment programs. The IRS got in trouble earlier in the year, let's say actually last year, in a series of cases that goes back to the Chai case from the Second Circuit and then the Grave case inside the tax court. And this dealt with what the IRS has to do under Section 6751B. To whenever they have an assessment of a penalty. And 6751B1 tells us that no penalty under this title shall be assessed unless the initial determination of such assessment is personally approved in writing by the immediately supervisory individual making such determination or such higher level official as the secretary may designate. The IRS had been caught, in essence, not doing that or not doing that properly. The Second Circuit had said if the IRS does not follow this and doesn't produce evidence that this happened, the penalties have to be thrown out. Now, the tax court in Grave 3, Grave went back and forth on this issue. Grave 3, they adopted the Second Circuit. They now follow the Second Circuit rule, which says that, you know, the IRS has to show approval of the penalty. Now let's turn to us. Now we start applying this to special cases, and this is a case we applied it to this year. This was a case of your standard garden vanilla, you know, tax protester who's filing a return that, oh, by the way, per IRS records, omitted like $95,000 worth of income. Basically, the IRS did the automated, you know, system came out and said, hey, you know, you filed a return with nothing. We're showing $95,000 of income. And it said, you know, we therefore believe you've underreported your income by $95,000. We assess you a nice chunk of tax, right? Well over $5,000 worth of tax, and actually $13,832 was the actual number. And because of that, because the penalty was greater than 10% of the tax actually due, actually it's 100% of the tax actually due, or $5,000, which is well over $5,000, then it automatically kicked in the 20% substantial understatement penalty under 6662. Now, that understatement penalty applies, like I said, whenever you have a shortfall in tax that's determined that's greater than the 10% or $5,000. The tax protester, as probably is not surprising, sent back a letter that basically didn't really deal with the issues. So there was no actual response to the matter. So eventually the IRS issues a 30-day letter. The protester does not take advantage of the 30-day, go to appeals period. So the computer automatically goes to assessment, and that assessment contains a 20% penalty. Now here's the problem. When that goes to assessment, and assessment does a 20% penalty, does that actually in the 90-day letter, that's the point at which we're supposed to have had the approval. Question, in this case, is that approval required? Because of the lack of response, so now we're at the trigger point. The tax court decided that in this particular case, there's an exception. 6751B2B2 has an exception that approval rule does not apply to any penalty automatically calculated through electronic means. The tax court studied why Congress put this in. The tax court concluded that this rule of supervisory approval was meant to prevent a rogue agent from threatening penalties in order to get a taxpayer to concede on an issue. The idea is the penalties have to be approved by the supervisor, so there has to be somebody at a higher level approving that. That's going to prevent a rogue agent from improving their numbers by threatening penalties at the exam level, because the supervisor is going to be in writing backing up the theory for the penalty, or the agent's not going to be able to push it forward. Well, they said in this case, there's no such risk. First thing is, this is a purely mechanical penalty. There's no judgment involved here. You can't really, because by the way, this penalty applies automatically unless the taxpayer shows the position had substantial authority, or the taxpayer had a reasonable basis. Basically, they behave reasonably trying to compute the right amount of tax. Both of those are burdens on the taxpayer to produce evidence. The argument is there's nothing to review here. And in fact, the IRS's Internal Revenue Manual on this issue says specifically that, if there's no response to the notice, that you go ahead and you assess the 20% penalty if it applies mechanically. However, if the taxpayer, right, submits a response, written or otherwise, that challenges the penalty or the amount of tax on the notice, then the IRS, the person who resolves that, who responds to that correspondence, needs to go and get supervisory approval to assess the penalty now. If they decide, nope, you're not right, we're not going to go along with this, if they decide they're going to assess the penalty, they've got to get supervisory approval at that point. The tax court said that's the appropriate way to handle this, and the IRS has handled it appropriately, so therefore we do not have to, for automated penalties, if there's no response, the 20% substantial understatement penalty is a special case and can be applied. It is a published decision, so it's what the tax court's going to try to push going forward. We'll see. I don't feel real comfortable if this particular taxpayer appeals it, because the likelihood is they're going to be on the other issues, and this would be a bad tax appeal. But we'll see if anybody else takes this up later about how this works. Finally, well, the IRS may have had a good day in court there in Walchrist. They had a bad day in court with JPPB versus United States of America. And this is case number 16-15999, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the opinion came down on February the 26th. This deals with the question of the IRS, the requirement the IRS gives sufficient written notice, reasonable notice, to taxpayers of their intent to contact third party. This actually is found in section 7602C1 that says the IRS may not contact any person other than the taxpayer with respect to termination or collection of tax liability without providing reasonable notice in advance to the taxpayer that contacts with other persons other than the taxpayer may be made. The IRS states in publication one, and that publication one is that one page sheet that has a colorful front end with your rights, your bill of rights as a taxpayer, and then on the back has a bunch of other text. And you get that at the beginning of an exam. One part of that says potential third-party contacts, and it tells you generally the IRS will deal directly with you or your duly authorized representative. However, we sometimes talk with other persons if we need information that you have not been able to provide or to verify information we have received. If we do contact other persons, such as a neighbor, bank, employer, or employee, we'll generally need to tell them limited information such as your name. The law prohibits us from disclosing any more information that is necessary to obtain or verify the information we are seeking. Our need to contact other persons may continue as long as there is activity in your case. If we do contact other persons, you have a right to request a list of those contacted. Your request can be made by telephone, in writing, or during a personal interview. The IRS claims that notice given at the beginning of the exam is essentially carte blanche. They have now given reasonable notice that they may contact third parties, and therefore they can then go out and contact third parties whenever they want to. That's been, and according to the taxpayer advocate, that's been a position the IRS has advanced more and more. They've been far less likely in an exam to tell a taxpayer they're going to contact a third party now. They're coming back and always relying on this publication one notice. The question becomes, is that reasonable? This particular case involved an attorney that was selected for a National Research Project exam. Those are those really nasty exams that nobody likes, right? So the taxpayer, who was elderly and had illness issues, attempted to ask the IRS to be excused from the NRP program. The IRS refused. The taxpayer then filed suit in district court. 2 years after this notice went out to the taxpayer with the NRP program, the IRS decided to contact the Supreme Court of California. Now, why the contact the Supreme Court of California? Because this particular taxpayer, who's an attorney, accepted assignments from the Supreme Court of California to defend indigent defendants in capital cases. Okay. So the IRS asked the Supreme Court of California, issued a summons to the Supreme Court of California stating that they were going, you know, that they want information about the payments he had received, you know, the, what he'd been involved with, payments he'd received. They did so without telling the taxpayer. In fact, they went back twice. The second time, a notice of the summons came to the attention of their daughter, who was appointed as the representative. And she then brought the matter forward, and they filed this lawsuit claiming that the IRS had not given adequate notice. The Ninth Circuit said, you know, gang, publication one is not adequate notice. The Ninth Circuit said, the reason why this is there was the danger of reputational damage to a taxpayer. If the IRS contacts a taxpayer's employer or a significant customer, and I don't know which, I guess you'd kind of look at the Supreme Court in this case as a significant customer, that could damage the reputation of the taxpayer because it looks like they're in trouble with the IRS. And you know, your employer may not want an employee who's in trouble with the IRS. They don't need that kind of problem. You know, you can resolve this. They said you have to give the taxpayer the ability to provide the information themselves rather than going directly to third party. So the Ninth Circuit said publication one is nowhere near sufficient reasonable notice of the potential contact of third parties. That is a very broad kind of, you know, the good, like the shrink back notices on software. This is the sort of thing that it was early on. It was 2 years earlier. Nobody's going to remember this. You hadn't contacted them. They said that's not sufficient reasonable notice. Sorry, guys, forget it. So this is interesting because the Ninth Circuit, now you may find the IRS is going to have to do a lot more work in that area. They're not going to be able to do publication one cases. It'll be interesting as exams go forward. Outside the Ninth Circuit, the question is going to become, will the other circuits follow the Ninth's ruling in this case? Well, like I said, you're back in the middle of tax season. Time to apply what you've learned this year. We here at Kaplan are involved in developing a lot of courses for the upcoming tax season. A lot of state societies have booked those courses now, so we know, you know, things are going to be coming up. A lot of neat stuff involved. A lot of developments. We're going to be doing some more Tax Cuts and Jobs Act developments as the regs and everything come out. We'll be looking at other issues. We're going to have some new courses. In fact, I've got a couple of states that now have booked courses on the marijuana issue we talked about earlier here today. So we've got courses in that realm, both on the accounting and the tax side. So once you get done with tax season, take a look at your state society's offerings. There's going to be a bunch of them, and see what you want to get ready for this coming year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. And again, our updates are at the website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can send any questions or comments to me. My address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Twitter handle, @edzollers. And as I always note, I follow discussions on various tax news groups on Reddit, the /r/taxpros group. I follow posts there, and I'll step in on things I see of interest. I follow the California Society's Tax Talk group. That's open to any CPA or EA anywhere in the country. I should say any CPA or attorney, not EAs. You gotta remember who they open to. They're open to CPAs and attorneys. You have to get the right title there. Anywhere in the country. I'm also I also monitor the Connect sites for the state CPAs societies that have got membership in Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota. So if you see me there, you can post something there. I find those interesting places to interchange and get some more information about tax matters. With that, though, We're in the middle of this now, middle of tax season. Hope you're having a good tax season so far, or at least a one that you feel you're going to survive, because that's maybe the best we can do this year, following the year after Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And you'll come back here, and we will get back into this next week as we look at whatever comes out this coming week in the area of federal taxes.